And of course, our special guest, Donna Kaufman, and we're talking about her work, Final Exams, about Cyril Weck. We're going to be back, talk about a couple more cases, and then we'll take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Donna Kaufman with us. Donna, we can't do this program without bringing up the O.J. Simpson trial and getting your take on what Cyril Weck thinks all about this one.
Well, he was a part of the dream team that helped the defense, not in a large ongoing way, but he was he did consult with them. At the same time, and before we were writing together, I was working, as I mentioned, for the Inquirer at the time, writing about, you know, without any doubt that that O.J. was guilty, because I remembered that he had this history of domestic violence. I knew about that in advance. So, you know, it's one of these cases that really changed the way that people in the industry and just civilians look at the legal system. There was never a dream team defense case like this before, where all sorts of attorneys and great minds came together to help this person distract from the evidence and successfully do so. There was a criminal trial. Well, first of all, this was 1994 in June. O.J. was 46. His ex-wife, Nicole, was 35. A friend that she barely knew, Ron Goldman, was 25. He came to her house to drop off some glasses that she had left in a restaurant where he worked. She and others had been there earlier. And they encountered a killer with knife who was wearing gloves and basically just almost decapitated Nicole. And then Ron happened to show up in the courtyard at just the wrong time, and he got stabbed, and I think 25 times. They both died at the scene. O.J. said he was on a plane to Chicago at the time. But if you remember that trial, which was just the most interesting thing ever on television, you know, someone of my age, we remember Watergate, the Watergate hearings and that of, you know, amazing television. But the O.J. case was the first trial that I just sat, you know, eating popcorn and just aghast at what was going on. And
from the chase down the 405 in Los Angeles, Donna,
the whole thing was
high drama.
It was just all so very bizarre. And this guy that everybody loved, I mean, I'm not a football fan, but I remember his acting. He was really funny and the movies he was in. And he was a handsome, affable guy who had this horrible temper.
Sure.
And the more that started coming out about the forensic evidence, the more that you couldn't help but think this guy is guilty. So he was brought to trial, and 8 months after the murders, he was found not innocent, but not guilty. And that's after the jury, I think they were out maybe 4 hours, and it was, a five-month-long trial, and they were out for 4 hours. Are you kidding? And that included lunch. So everyone was really angry about that. But when I look at it a little dispassionately, I understand that the jurors saw something fishy. And one of the things they saw that was fishy was the blood evidence. There was blood of Nicole's on his stockings, on his socks, upstairs in his mansion. Well, that's interesting, but it was on the inside of the socks, as if it was planted there. A police nurse took samples, you know how they fill a little vial with blood when they do testing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that vial was carried around in an envelope, and they took a certain amount of blood, and they measured it and clocked it. And then when they looked at it again, there was like 1.5 cc's of blood missing. And what do you know? That blood on the sock and blood on the his blood on the back gate, which wasn't there when they collected it the first time. So if you look at nothing but that blood evidence, you go, somebody planted that blood. And I think what happened is the cops saw the reaction of people standing on the freeways with signs, "Go, Juice, go," as he was going on his crazy chase. And they needed to frame a guilty man, and they got caught. So that was the criminal trial. He was acquitted, but he was able to be tried civilly, and he ended up being found liable. And that was $33.5 million.
Which they've never collected.
He's never really paid to the victims, which include Nicole's family and her children and her sisters and whatnot, and as well as Ron's family, his parents who are divorced and his sister. So they've gotten like little amounts of money here and there from the sale of some of his stuff, but you know, he's never really paid his way on that either. The difference between the two cases, though, if you remember, in the civil trial, they had photos that they found of him wearing the shoes that he called ugly ass Bruno Mali shoes, which they, unfortunately, this was not found in time for the criminal trial, but they did find them for the civil, and that matched. It was a very strange shoe that happened to match the footprints that were in blood at the crime scene. And O.J. had said, "Oh, I don't own those shoes," and there's a picture of him wearing the shoes. During the criminal trial, I said to my editor, "You know what? I remember him wearing those gloves. The same gloves that were found, one glove was found at the scene of the crime, and one was found at his mansion by Mark Furman." And so when photos of those were hitting the press, I said to my editor, "You know, I've seen O.J. wearing those gloves before." So they go through the files, and they go, "Well, he's wearing them at a Buffalo game when he's walking across the, the yard, and but they're brown, and the ones in the they were black, the ones that were found." And I said, "Yes, but Nicole bought two pair of gloves. She bought brown and she bought black." So that we had, you know, that was kind of a big reveal during the criminal trial, but it wasn't enough to make the jury find him guilty and put him away. He got put away for this silly robbery that happened years later, and he
it's karma, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know, it's kind of like Al Capone getting sent up for tax evasion instead of all the murders and all the stuff that he did. It's like, it's not right.
Yeah, but Capone thought he was going to get off because they didn't have the bookkeeper. They had nothing.
Is that so? Oh my gosh, that's funny. Well, again, the old arrogance really gets you. Well, one of the things that may have changed things in the criminal case for O.J., two things. There was a video of a pilot he did for NBC called Frogman, where he played a Navy SEAL, and there's a scene where he comes up behind somebody and slits their throat with a knife that is very much like the knife that was used on Nicole. And the jury was not allowed to see that, and it's a real shame. And in fact, that film is still under seal. It's all the copies were collected, and they're in a police archive somewhere, and they can't be looked at. Which I'd love to see that film, but I know what that scene is. I've read the script, and there was a witness named Jill Shively, who was driving through West L.A. at the time when O.J. was fleeing the scene. And I'm not scared to say that I believe this was O.J. that was the killer. So, you know, tough beans, O.J., come after me if you don't like it. And
by the way, they said he's dying of a brain tumor or something, or is that just bogus?
I don't believe that. But he right after he's fleeing the scene, and he almost runs into her with his car, and she looks at him and says, you know, that's O.J. Simpson. She saw him clear as a bell, and she was never allowed to testify because she took money from the tabloids. She took a handful of money, for like a couple thousand dollars from the tabloids, from TV tabloids and from Star Magazine. And they thought that was so shocking at the time. Now, you know, compare that to the Casey Anthony case, where now everyone knows, everyone sells their story. That's just how it is in America today. And you make that clear to the jury. Okay, this guy took $1,000 for, his story, but he still has a story. You still let that person talk. That would have been a really valuable witness that might have changed things. Who knows?
Who knows? Let's take some calls here for you. Anita is in New York City. Welcome to the show, Anita.
Hi, good morning. Pardon. Very fascinating show. I have a couple brief comments in terms of the discussion and then a main question. First of all, that was with the OJ case, that was a professional hit. And I don't think that was karma in terms of what happened to him subsequent. I think that that's called the misuse of the judicial system. And I just want to suggest, George and Donna, that you look at the tape in the convenience store regarding Ferguson, mm-hmm. because I heard Dick Gregory, and he says that if you look closely, you'll see that Michael had on red and white Nikes in that tape. And, you know, when he was lying in the street for 4 hours or what have you, he had on flip-flops, okay? And Dick Gregory also mentioned that if you check the date, it's June 6th date as opposed. So, yeah, there's lots of machinations going on.
Well, that's very interesting. And I love Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory was a huge person to wake up America about the assassination of John Kennedy. I have great regard for him. So I'd like to know more about that, the shoes business, because that's really interesting. I don't know about that. I do disagree with you about this was a hit on, hey, we can disagree. That's fine. But no, I think OJ did the hitting there.
Didn't some private investigator come out with a report saying that maybe someone else did it?
He's been after OJ's son. And you have to wonder what is making this guy do this, because he spent a lot of money to support this, in my mind, Fakakta theory of, the older son did this because he was insulted that she didn't come to the restaurant where he was cooking. I don't buy it. It doesn't make any sense. And O.J. makes all the sense in the world. You know, O.J. was the violent creep in that family, not anyone else.
Next up, we go to Joe in the Bronx in New York.
Hey,
Joseph, take good, Joe.
I'd like to ask your guest, Donna Kaufman, about whether she knows if there was an autopsy done on Jimi Hendrix, and if so, did Dr. Weck have any input on that?
No, he did not. I'm sure there was. Did he die in London? He died in London, didn't he?
Hendrix? I'm not sure. I know Morrison died in Paris.
Yeah. And there was an autopsy in Morrison. I'm not really sure about where he died, and in America, if you die unattended, you're not in the hospital.
Yeah, he died in London. You're right. 1970.
Okay. So I'm not sure. I would assume that there was an autopsy. I've written extensively about the Brian Jones death, but in that one, Dr. Wecht hasn't worked on Jimi Hendrix. I don't think there's much mystery about that one. But he is actually working on Kurt Cobain. You know, there's kind of a new way of looking at that, some new evidence that has come out recently. And there may be some changes in that case. But, Dr. Wecht, out of every five patients that come up across his morgue table, two and a half of them, half of them, are drug deaths. So people die of combined drug toxicity all the time, and they don't think that they're drug addicts because they're not doing illegal drugs. They're doing pharmaceuticals, which are so much more dangerous. And then if you mix that with, you know, even cold medicine or alcohol or something, boy, you know, it's so easy to just slip away. It's just a terrible thing we're seeing more and more and more and more of.
Did he look at the Whitney Houston case?
Oh, yes. And I worked a lot on that case. That is a real pickle of a case. You know,
talk about sad. What a talent. Jeez.
Oh, I know. I loved her voice so much. She died in a bathtub in Beverly Hills, a drowning death with contributing factor of cocaine abuse. She basically blew out her sinus cavity from extensive cocaine. What is interesting about it is whether it was properly investigated. Beverly Hills has its own police department, but if there's a crime of a homicide and you investigate every case as if it were a homicide, if it's done properly, and then you decide, no, it's not, it's this instead. But you put all the guns in there just to look at, could it be a homicide, and what are the, you know, signs that point in that direction. That never happened. They never consulted the cops, the wizened detectives in the robbery homicide division of LAPD. So what they have is there was a huge patch of skin on her backside, on her tailbone, that was missing. It was just burned off. What does that tell you? If you're going into a bathtub that 6 hours after she was in, her body was scooped out of the tub, 6 hours later, that bathtub water was still 98 degrees. Imagine how hot it was when she went in. Why would she go in? It's almost as if somebody lifted her up and put her into the bathtub. So, and there were all sorts of other things that I've written about where did people, the things that were going on in her life in the days leading up to this, that she was belligerent and having fights with people, perhaps, you know, owing a lot of money to drug dealers. She was in this room by herself, but there were several dinners from room service. Did they even ask these guys who ordered all this food? Plus, she was going to dinner. Why would she be eating all that? Why would she have downers in her system if she was going to perform that night? This was the night before the Grammys in 2012, and she wanted to show Clive Davis and the show business world that she had a voice again, which she didn't, but, you know, that she had viability. Invest in me again. I'm coming back. I'm making a comeback. And she did have projects, movies lined
up. Well, she did have a lot. We'll be back with Final Calls next. On our next Coast to Coast program, Mark Cushman joins us. We're going to be talking about incredible old-time television shows from the 60s, and you're going to love it. It's our next Coast to Coast show. Okay, welcome back, and our dear friend Donna Kaufman here. You having a good time with us, Donna?
You know, this is so much fun. I can't believe it, and the hours are just zipping by, and I still have 1,000 cases to talk to you about, so I'm going to have to come back.
It is a very fast show, and we're having a great time with you,
too. Oh, and tomorrow night's show with the 60s TV. Ooh, wow. I can't wait for that. Wow.
I wonder if you wrote it. No, you're too young to write Britain.
Well, I watched it. That's where I learned everything.
Yep, absolutely. We touched on a little bit Sirhan Sirhan, who claims that he had really no recollection of what he did. But in the beginning, he did plead guilty. So what happens here?
Well, he had a lawyer that made him do that. The same lawyer who allowed this to go to trial without producing, without the jury having seen the autopsy report. Now, what kind of lawyer would do that? A lawyer that wants to have his client take the punishment that the, you know, he wasn't a proper defense attorney. he was a clone of the prosecution. This was just a botch. But there is there's a fellow named William Pepper who's been
who's representing him now. That's right.
And I really hope that someday there can be some justice there. The problem is, every time Sirhan goes up against the parole board and they go, well, are you ready to admit it? He can't admit it because he doesn't remember. Now, what kind of mind game? I mean, I'm sure you know just all the experts on this, but he was really implanted with notions that made him do what he did and then forget about it. And even though they've tried over the years to deprogram him, it still has a worm through his brain and he can't remember what happened. But he is falsely convicted just on the fact that he did not shoot Robert Kennedy. He could not have done that. He was not close enough to do that shot 2 inches behind the right ear. So and until they can explain that, and there are 1,000 witnesses in that room who said he was never any closer than a foot and a half to Kennedy's left front. So it is physically impossible for him to have shot the senator.
They did find a gun in his hand, though, right?
Oh, yeah, he was shooting. 5 other people got wounded, none fatally, but he was shooting like a madman. And in fact, some people say there were 14 bullets found, and I think his gun only had 8 or 9, I forget now. But, come on. I mean, this is an absolute shameful episode of American justice. And also journalistic malpractice. That's a term that Dr. Wecht has come up with that I just love, because there are sometimes when the press just buys what they're told and they don't question. And when you have forensic evidence like this, that you say, okay, fine, explain this evidence then. And nobody does it, and nobody cares. And one of the biggest offenders to me is the Kennedy family. Now, I understand Jackie, and, I get why she took her kids and went to Greece for a while. But the Robert Kennedy had 11 children that don't seem to want to find the answers of what happened to their dad. They don't seem to have any sense of justice about this man in jail for a crime he didn't commit. He did shoot his gun that day. He deserves some prison time, but he does not deserve to be called the assassin of Robert Kennedy.
Sometimes you wonder if the children have been told, stay out of this.
Yeah, or they just know not to open that. I mean, by the way, Dr. Wecht and I are writing this book about the JFK case, and one of the things he discovered when he was a young man, the first forensic pathologist able to go into the archives and look at the evidence, and he inspected President Kennedy's shirt and jacket, and he saw the various elements that are at the archives. I mean, it was just amazing history he's holding in his hand, and he asks, "Where's the brain?" Because the brain is on a list that's supposed to be there. But the brain is gone. How do you get rid of the most significant piece of evidence that would have told you from which direction came those bullets?
To the phones we go again. Rusty is in Snowmass, Colorado. Hey, Rusty, go ahead. Still with us, Rusty? Nope, he's gone. Oh, well. Joe's with us, though, Knoxville, Tennessee. Joe, go ahead.
Oh, I was wanting to talk more about that with O.J. Simpson.
Sure.
What do you think about Glenn Edward Rogers, the serial killer, known as the Casanova killer or cross-country killer?
Yeah. His brother decided to write a book and say that, there are a lot of people who do that and turn on a relative because then they can maybe get a movie out of it or something. It's all done for financial reasons, but I don't believe that at all. It doesn't fit with the evidence. It doesn't match what What we know, I mean, this guy Rogers is a piece of work, and he had nothing to do with O.J. Simpson. But I will tell you something, because I'm fair and I want to be honest. In the hat that was found at the scene, there were Caucasian hairs on the inside of the hat. But there was too much evidence that leads to O.J. But a defense attorney could point and did point to those hairs and say, oh, you know, look at this. But were they Nicole's hairs? Were they the kids' hairs? You know, who knows? But they were unidentified hair in the inside of the ski cap.
Cyril Wecht is 83 years old. Where does he get all his energy, Donna?
Boy, I wish I knew. I wish he could bottle it for all of us because he is amazing. Like I say, three autopsies a day, and then he goes to court. And he's the kind of guy that if you're walking down the street with him in Pittsburgh, people stop their cars and get out and go, run over and ask for an autograph. It's like being with Willie Brown in San Francisco. I mean, he's a beloved figure in his town. But pretty much wherever he goes, people say, tell me about Kennedy. Tell me about this. Tell me about... And whatever he's doing, he'll just stop and talk to people and explain as best he can. And sometimes he doesn't have all the answers. Sometimes it's frustrating. Like one case that was interesting, he came on as a defense witness in the Scott Peterson case, as did Dr. Henry Lee, the criminalist. And they looked at all the evidence. 93 bags of evidence were taken from the home where Lacey Peterson, the pregnant wife of Scott Peterson, lived with her husband, and they found nothing that led to looking at Scott as the perpetrator. If you remember, on the first few days, Larry King show and other shows, the family, while they were still looking for Lacey, said, "Oh, Scott wouldn't." Her family said, "Scott wouldn't do this. He's a loving husband. He wouldn't do this." Well, then the Inquirer found Amber Fry, who was his mistress, and she was this bombshell witness who ended up testifying against him because she didn't know she thought he was a widow. She didn't realize he was still married.
That ticked her off.
And so that shows you that even though that wasn't forensic evidence, that was really evidence that changed the shape of this case. And he was such a creep. I mean, he called Amber from, he said he was in Europe. He couldn't be with her over the holidays because he was in Europe. And he was calling from, I think it was like Denmark, and saying, "Oh, I hurt my foot on the cobblestone streets." And then this dog starts barking in the background. He goes, "Oh, I got to get a new hotel. This dog won't shut up." And then he calls her the next time. This is all recorded because the cops are saying, "Get him talking, get him talking. We think he did this." And she's playing along. So then he goes to France, and he's talking about, "Oh, and then I had this, you know, this wonderful meal in France, and I wish you were here. And well, next time you'll come with me on one of my business trips, and you'll." And then there's this dog that's barking, and he goes, "Oh, there's another dog that." Well, he's actually home in Modesto, and that's his dog barking, and the dog is saying, "He did it. He killed Lacey." It's the same dog that gets all over Europe. So Scott is lying to her about where he's at in this, you know, trying to make himself Mr. Big who travels all around, when in fact he was literally a fertilizer salesman in Modesto and the Fresno area. She was in Fresno at the time, the girlfriend. So, you know, there was so much evidence when it started to come in, because sometimes it takes a while to analyze, to collect and analyze phone records and computer records. And by the time that stuff came in and they put their best people on it, it was very obvious that Scott Peterson did kill his wife. And he lost the support of his in-laws, and they're, you know, radically. And yet he never did lose the support of his parents, who his mom died last year, and she went to her grave thinking that, you know, her son was railroaded. I was at that trial, which was in Redwood City, California, and Scott would come in before the jury, and it was like he was hosting the Tonight Show when he would come through in a suit, because, of course, you don't put someone on trial in their prison garb. He would come in and kind of wave at the crowd and wink at his mom and blow kisses and act like he was, you know, Mr. Big on television. And then the jury would come in and he'd act like really somber. And it was just odd.
Strange. Yeah. Nancy is in Avalon, California. Go ahead, Nance. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Excuse me.
Sure.
A few months ago, there was a guest host on your on Coast to Coast with a guest who presented a very convincing case that JonBenet Ramsey was murdered by Edward Wayne Edwards. He was a devil worshiper. He murdered many people and died in prison. And he had been acting as a Santa Claus. And JonBenet told a neighbor that Santa would be visiting her home not on Christmas Eve, but on Christmas night. So it was believed that she opened the door and permitted him to enter. And so I don't know where you were at the time of that program, but it was Coast to Coast. So that's all I have to say. And
well, there are a number of people who have been floated. In fact, there was
that was Detective John Cameron, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
There was a Bill McReynolds who was the Santa Claus who was at the Christmas party, and he was looked at as a suspect for a while because there was that comment that she made to a friend's mom that Santa was going to come and visit. But you know, all the evidence does not point to any intruder, period. No intruder did this. It doesn't make sense. But you will never run short of people theorizing stuff and, you know, saying what they, it's America, they can say what they want to say, but shame on these people who blame people who don't deserve to be blamed. I mean, not you, ma'am, but I'm saying, you know, these other people, like the brother of Rogers and stuff, who try to make a dime on...
Did he ever look at the case of Ted Bundy?
Well, Ann Rule did. Ann Rule wrote... You know, she was a mom of five, single mom of five. She was writing for detective magazines under a man's name because at that time you couldn't write as a female, that kind of stuff. And she was a police officer in Seattle. And on the nights, she would go to the she'd just volunteer at the suicide hotline. And one of the people who was alone with her in the room was this really handsome, nice kind of young Republican guy, and his name was Ted Bundy, and he'd walk her out to her car and say, "Ooh, you've got to be careful." This is before his killing streak began. So she wrote the first seminal book called The Stranger Beside Me and covered his case and all its permutations as he went from Utah to Florida, where he finally got busted and executed. And, you know, there's nobody who knows that case better than Ann. But
okay.
No, I never worked it. And I wasn't, you know, I just know it through her eyes.
Rusty's back in Snowmass, Colorado. There you go, Rusty.
Yeah, how you guys doing tonight?
Hey,
good,
Rusty.
Rusty.
We thought we
doing
lost
great.
You.
Listen, I wanted to talk about the first topic you guys brought up tonight about Anna Poe and the situation with Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
I actually lived about, I don't know, seven, maybe eight blocks from that hospital. And that hospital's changed hands several times through the last years. And now it's an Ochsner hospital.
Yes, it is.
And after that storm, I don't know if you guys really remember, but after, generally when a hurricane clears through, right after a hurricane finishes up, it's hot.
Yep.
I mean, it's hot. It's hot like you've never experienced in your life.
Right.
Hot. It's like being on the equator. Okay? It's so hot, and the sun, like, there's not a cloud in the sky, and it's 100 degrees.
Yeah, I write about that. I mean, no one's saying it was paradise. It was hell. And but the book, you will like this book, I'm sure. Get it at the library. I don't care if you buy it. But it's called A Question of Murder, and it gets into everything that was going on there and the irrefutable evidence that this woman got away with all these murders.
Donna, almost out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program. Do you still write comedy or strictly these books?
I do, actually, yes. I wrote some jokes not long ago for the mayor of New York City and for someone else who was giving a speech there. And, you know, I do keep my fingers in the pie because I love that. I love it. But this keeps me pretty busy, and we'll see where, you know, the future goes. But, you know, what a blast it is to be with you and to have your freewheeling audiences so interested in everything and you leading the parade. It's been a treat, and your whole team is great.
Thank you, Donna. Donna Kaufman, the book, Final Exams. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.